This is the Fighting the Good Fight podcast, defending taxpayers and solving their tax problems with your host, Patricia Gentile. Patricia Gentile is a taxpayer defense attorney, CPA, the founder of New England Tax Relief, and Patricia L. Gentile Coaching. With 40 years of IRS expertise and experience, she has successfully defended and resolved difficult IRS situations for hundreds of taxpayers. Patricia coaches tax professionals to confidently identify their client's IRS problem and create a successful resolution plan for them. As a fierce advocate, a creative strategist, and solution finder, fighting the good fight with Patricia Gentile is both her passion and purpose to help tax professionals successfully resolve their clients' tax problems.
Welcome. I'm your host, Patricia Gentile, and my guest today is Charles Markham.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. Welcome. I'm very excited to have you on so we can chat about this area that you bring forth today for the tax resolution problem solvers. You earned your undergraduate degree from MIT in Boston in 1984, and you have a master's of science in taxation from Bentley College here in Massachusetts in 1995. You're an enrolled agent, and that's when your tax career over 30 years ago literally began, is as an enrolled agent. You've also earned your CPA, and you're a United States tax court practitioner, which is very impressive. Your practice is both tax preparation for around 400 clients annually and a tax problem resolution practice. Over 10 years, you've been engaged by the IRS to write and review test questions for the enrolled agent licensing exam.
Yep.
That's pretty cool. You were elected to the National Association of Tax Professionals, also known as NATP. Their National Board of Directors in 2021 and reelected this year. And you currently serve as treasurer. The other item I wasn't aware of is that the Financial Regulatory Authority.
FINRA.
Right, FINRA. You were selected by them to serve as an arbitrator to hear securities industry disputes. If you could just...
fun. Love hearing about myself.
Well, you know, you can celebrate all these accomplishments, but they are labors of love. You know, I'm like you said, I've known you for 2+ decades now. You actually still have the passion for all these areas.
Yep.
And work them. Going to that, you have both a tax return preparation practice and a tax representation, resolution practice. Expand upon how you do both.
Well, when I started doing taxes, I did, I think like many tax professionals, I looked to diversify. And so, for example, at one point I said, oh, I want to be a one-stop shop. And I got my securities licenses and I started saying, you can do taxes with me and we can open up an IRA for you and all that. God bless the people who can keep all that, those particular balls in the air. It really didn't work for me. I didn't like, people would come in to do their taxes and they'd be mad at me because the market had gone down, Anyway, so I got away from that. I also tried expanding into bookkeeping by hiring a bookkeeper. I could never seem to make that work either. And God bless those people who can do it. Eventually, and really quite naturally, it is sort of part of my personality. I got into tax representation by the NAEA has something, the National Association of Enrolled Agents has something called NTPI, where you learn about representation. In my MST program, they had practice and procedure courses, and I just loved all those courses. And so I sort of naturally got into representation. Initially, it actually can come from your clients. One of your clients gets selected for audit, and there's your on-the-job training on doing an audit.
Right, right.
But to me, I expanded from my tax practice, and I've always had my feet sort of planted in both universes, the tax prep universe and the tax resolution. And at least for me, the way I would explain it to somebody is I would say, well, what does that mean? Well, first off, it means that if you're a tax prep client of mine and you get selected for an audit or you get a notice, I'm no shrinking violet. Let's go have at it. Not a problem. I'll defend it all the way now to the steps of the courthouse and inside if we had to. And that's, I think, reassuring. I think there are a lot of tax preparers that are honestly afraid of the IRS. And I mean, the way they, they would immediately refer you to somebody else, and that's fine. I understand that. The other side of it is that on the tax representation side, I'm very familiar with, tax liabilities. And so a lot of people involved in taxpayer representation are, they just focus on collectability. You can't pay it. We're going to do an offer and compromise and all that. Because I do taxes so much, I'm very well aware of some of the issues that, hey, maybe you really don't owe this tax. In many cases, people hadn't even thought about that. I mean, they just, I have a tax problem. Now that doesn't happen the majority of the time, but it happens a significant portion of the time. And those are my most interesting cases and the ones I like the most, because we're really not dealing with collectability. We're dealing with, hey, they don't owe the money anyway. Everybody has a right to only pay the correct amount of tax.
Exactly. You, exactly. I love that approach. When we were talking the other day, it was like a light bulb went off in my head saying, God, how often do you actually stop, even ask that question, unless it's really obvious that the client doesn't owe the liability that the IRS has assessed? The Taxpayer Bill of Rights, as the IRS states it here, is the 10 rights all taxpayers have anytime they interact with the IRS. And then that these 10 rights cover a wide range of topics and issues and explain what taxpayers can expect if they need to work with the IRS on a tax matter. It includes when a taxpayer files a return, pays taxes, responds to a letter or notice, like you're referencing here, or goes through an audit or an appeals and an IRS decision. But the Taxpayer Bill of Rights you just mentioned specifically is number three, that says the right to pay no more than the correct amount of tax. And I think that's a really good approach. And with you having your sleeves rolled up in both annual tax return preparation with your 400 plus clients, along with taking on tax representation and resolution cases, I can see where you're thinking that way. And when you first approach a problem client, that your first thoughts could be, do they owe the money at all? I love, we talked about the other day, I love the grandmother story.
A woman came to me. She was not the grandmother. She was the grandmother's daughter. Okay. And grandma has a problem. She lived in Quincy. She owned a house with no mortgage. So she had all that equity. That was a two family, I believe. And she had co-signed my horrible nephew's student loans, about $80,000. Nobody in the family, he needed a loan for school. I think it wasn't a full federal government student loan. It was something else, some like quasi bank student loan. And she had co-signed it. And so this is a story of no good deed goes unpunished. And of course, the nephew, school didn't work out, and he left, basically wound up defaulting on $80,000 of student loan debt. They eventually came after her, and I guess she convinced them pretty quickly that, I live on Social Security, and I can't pay this, and they just dropped it. and they issued some 1099-Cs, which is the form that you get from a bank or a credit card company for cancellation of indebtedness. And it seems reasonable that she co-signed a debt and the debt was canceled. So that becomes $80,000 of taxable income to her. And that wound up being something like $25,000-$30,000 originally. And then after interest and penalties, I think she didn't include it on her tax return. And she got what's called a CP 2000 notice, and they assessed it. And now grandma owes $30,000-$40,000 continuing to grow. They put a lien on the house. And of course, this is the type of person that starts getting the pennies on the dollar notices from the offer and compromise people, like, and, you know, hey, can't we do something? And that's how they approach me. You know, can you help me with this? And I looked at the situation and a little light bulb went off in my head where I said, you know, I don't know if she really owes this money. And I did the research, and I actually in some notes here, there's some sites that say, no, when you guarantee a note, to be honest, you're probably not supposed to get the 1099-C, but the bank didn't know that. There's a lovely case apparently called Landreth versus Commissioner 50 TC 80 803, and I love this language. It's straight from a court case. Sometimes you love it when these judges write good stuff that said, the guarantor no more realizes income from the transaction than he would if a tornado bearing down on his home, threatening a loss, changes course and leaves the house intact. and just to drive the point is that when you receive a loan, like the nephew or her grandson had received the $80,000, he got value from that. He got supposedly an education. He would say he didn't get any value, but that's what we would say, he got an education, or I don't know what. But she didn't get any. And so therefore, when that debt's forgiven, he has cancellation of indebtedness income. She didn't get any value from co-signing that note. So when that debt goes away, it's not income to her. So once again, we didn't, the way we approached this was not an offer and compromise. And the fact that she has all that equity in the home would be very challenging to get that offer and compromise done. It'd have to be done with special circumstances and all that. Rather, we did an audit reconsideration and supplied the documents and all these sites, and poof, it all went away.
Oh, that's excellent. Another option, this is not what the instructions say, the IRS instructions under the offer and compromise, doubt mm-hmm. as to liability.
Oh, that's true.
You know what? For our listeners, why don't you explain what audit reconsideration is?
So there's an audit reconsideration. The units that hopefully people that are in our business know about what a CP 2000 is and what the automated under reporter unit, the AUR unit is. Those are very famous notices. Now, each of those departments has their own reconsideration department. Okay. And my experience with them is actually can be slow, but tremendously positive. So the idea that somebody got an AUR notice, didn't respond to it, a CP 2000 notice, didn't respond to it, and then you go back and you actually submit the documentation. I think there's somebody who works in that particular department, and I think 9 times out of 10, they abate it. So I would strongly recommend, that's a nice place. That's, in this case, this was an AUR unit. It's a nice place to go to. Now, if you are in an examination and then you seek to have that reopen, there's a separate set of addresses for examinations. I find they're reasonably good to work with too. However, they tend to expect, actually both of these sort of departments, when you submit something to them, you're not submitting, hey, we really don't think we owe this, give us a call. You pretty much want to give them a package, right, of the receipts and sort of honestly your expectation should be that what you should be sending them is so complete that they got it, and they'll do what you're telling them to do, and you don't hear from them. So, you know, and I've had that work out really well too. And the doubt as to liability, I agree with you. You can try that approach. That, you know, stops the statute from running and things like that. So,
yeah. Actually, expound on the statute from running. What do you mean by that?
So every debt has a 10-year clock that's ticking. It starts from the day the tax is assessed. So if you file a tax return and you mail it in a few months later, whatever, they actually assess the tax. And if you haven't paid it, the 10-year clock starts running. There are, and if you're in this business, you know, you see tax debts expire all the time. And I mean, it's a long time for 10 years, but sometimes somebody comes to you and there's 2 or 3 years left on the statute and you go, you know, you could submit an offer and compromise, but let's just see what happens, you know, if we can get this in a good position. So the submitting an offer. So there are things, however, that stop this clock mm-hmm. from ticking, filing for bankruptcy, initiating an installment agreement. While they're thinking about the installment agreement, the clock is stopped, not the during the entire installment agreement. Going out of the country for more than 6 months can stop the clock from ticking. Obviously, you live abroad, then the clock never runs. But filing an offer and compromise, whether it's for collectability or liability, that's one of the things that stops the clock from ticking while they're considering it a little bit of time after.
Yeah, and this clock is actually known as the collection statute. That the IRS has 10 years from date of assessment to collect the tax debt, tax interest and penalties, the debt to the IRS. And what you were mentioning are what they deem to be events that will toll or stop this clock. But you're absolutely right about how you would, that practitioners in the tax resolution professionals need to know what is left on that collection clock. You know, how much time is left that the IRS has to collect that tax debt? And that is very much how you would consider the approach to resolving and recommending to your client the type of tax resolution program that might be in their best interest, that also doesn't jeopardize their ability to have, if not all of their tax debt, but some of their tax debt written off because the collection statute expiration date has come about. And I love seeing that on account transcripts, seeing those words write off. You actually see those two words write yep. off. And then see the big, right? The big minus. And that is a part of strategy. I have placed clients on installment agreements, knowing that within the time period that they're paying, certain tax years are going to be written off during that time. And that helps very much.
I just want to say what's interesting
yeah,
is
go ahead.
When they do write it off, they never send out a notice saying we've written this off.
Just look
at the transcript and it's now zero.
I did see that you mentioned in your tips and recommendations for it, not just aspiring, but any tax problem resolution professional. What are your tips and recommendations for them?
Well, first off, in terms of transcripts, and you know, Pitbull is certainly one. I use one called it's from a company called it's called Tax Help Software. They actually call the product Audit Detective, but they have a program. There's several programs out there where they log into the IRS and they just download the transcripts onto your computer. But the other side of that, in order to do that, is I require, so this is on my tax prep clients, but also obviously my tax resolution clients, I require an 8821. So that's a sort of like the power of attorney, but not. The 8821 is just an information authorization. But I require every single client of mine to sign an 8821. Then I fax it into the IRS, and then that and after, then I'm allowed to download their transcripts. And I mean, 400 clients, that's a process, but now I have this huge database of clients. And then the beauty of the tax help software is you download it. You do this thing where it goes and downloads overnight all your 1,000 names or whatever you have your tracking. And then when you look on a login screen, it says, this is what's new. This person's been selected for an audit.
Wow.
And that audit notice goes on their client about 6 months before they get a letter in the mail.
Wow, that's great.
So that's interesting. If they get selected for the CP2000 notice, that gets flagged. And there's actually an opportunity to, when you see there's a, they've been flagged. Wait a minute, what happened? And so you go and you look, and you look at the return you filed, and you look at their wage and income, and you see what has caught the attention of the CP2000 unit. And let's say it's a 1099-R, it's a retirement money, had some taxes withheld. And, you know, there's so many people, they get the inheritance from granddad. Thank you very much, dad. We always think, you know, and their tax is taken out, and then they don't record it on their tax return. They think, oh, it's all been taken care of. That's actually a reasonably legitimate thing, but likely are the taxes are not enough. They actually owe money on the windfall, and they're about to get a notice. Well, if they haven't gotten the notice, you can very quickly file an amended return. Now you're just gonna do what you should do, but that gets rid of the accuracy penalty because you filed the amended return before you actually got the notice. And
great tip.
20% accuracy penalty is an accuracy penalty. Now this is for a tax preparation client, but what can happen is, so when you do the 8821s, you get copies of the notices in the mail. And like I said, sometimes you get advance warning by looking at the transcripts. So I will, I mean, the gold standard, I'm not saying I achieve the gold standard, but I frequently do. The gold standard is that I get a copy of the notice at my PO box. I look at it, but there's always a little bit of moment for me too, but clients are, I'm a little desensitized to IRS notices, but you know, I look at it and go, oh, this isn't an issue at all. And I'll email my client, hey, if you haven't gotten it yet, when you get home today from work, you may have a notice from the IRS or it might come a day or two. I want you to know I've already spoken to them and resolved this. And it's, don't even think about it. Right. And that's the gold standard. And that's one of the, so in other words, that's how I sell them. If there's any selling, although it's required, but that's how I motivate them to sign that 8821. And my other tip, just this is for the tax preparation side, is that I send that 80. So I send the 8821 because it expires after a few years. If they need to file a new one, I send it to them when I send them their taxes along with the 8879 and all the other forms they have to sign.
Right.
And so, they're just kind of in a signing mood. So I just did it all at once. It is something I have to every year. But see, I'm one of these people that the beauty of having the 8821, if somebody says to me, I paid these estimated taxes, I log on to the account and I look and it's a trust but verify. You know, did you pay these taxes? I mean, sometimes they, and then I obviously will resolve it in the front and they won't get a notice, even though, you know, I've had situations where I've taken their information verbatim and I didn't check and then they get a scary gram. And of course it looks like I screwed up something.
Right. Good advice about that form 8821. I think it is underused. I actually do. I think from what I've heard from a lot of tax resolution professionals, they go right to the 2848 a lot because of
their position,
yeah,
of representation. You know, they're going to represent on a on a tax problem case. However, I love that you actually use this right from the get-go with your tax return preparation clients. And it reminds me of, in your website, in your content, you know, you state that there's a phrase that you use called, I've got your back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having everybody sign that to put in their tax return file,
mm-hmm,
you know, you really do have their backs, because yes, you'll know, and you'll be able to jump on it or reassure them, I'm aware of this, and, you know, whatever the resolution is for that. And it comes out of the fact that you've prepared the returns.
When you're in this business, you're fairly desensitized to these IRS notices.
Yeah, true.
And when the clients get them, they must get, you know, I could appreciate a client seeing a routine IRS notice meaning nothing and getting just the sickest feeling in the pit of their stomach. And so if you can, you know, help them with that and take care of it, then, you know, that's the right thing. And I also wanted to mention, on the problem resolution clients, I will have them sign both an 8821 and a 2848. That's because I very much like to, I think each of those comes with different responsibilities. And if somebody has a problem and I do wind up, I use the 8821, I want to see their transcripts. Maybe I have a question or something that I talk to the hotline people about. If you have a 2848 on file and your client owes money, they can completely start approach. Hey, wait a minute, before you go, how are you resolving this balance too? I've even had that from the hotline. So if you do an 8821, they're effectively neutered and you can't negotiate. And I sometimes don't want to be in negotiating posture. I just want to be in an information gathering posture when I'm at the beginning of the relationship with a resolution client. Once I've decided we're going to go forward and here's what we're going to do, okay, then the 2848 goes on file.
Yeah. When you're mentioning the hotline, the formal title for that is the Practitioner's Priority Service,
mm-hmm,
that we all refer to as PPS. Before we wrap up, I wanted to have you expound on the Internal Revenue Manual as another tip or recommendation for tax problem resolution professionals.
Yeah. When I got started, the Internal Revenue Manual was available in a bound set of volumes that were constantly being updated. I would actually sit and read the thing. Now it's available online. It's at irs.gov/IRM. And it's got 20 different, 25 different sections. But if you're involved with, if you're dealing with collections, for example, that's section 5. I'm telling you, you should read section 5 from start to finish. I know you won't, retain it. You won't be able to like recite it back, but when you see what the IRS instructions to the employees, it's very enlightening. This is what they're supposed to do. This is when they're supposed to ask their manager for approval. This is where like they shouldn't bother your client in this circumstance. It's very, very helpful. I can't tell you how many times, if I've got a unique situation, if I've got somebody who's in an employment tax examination, I'm going to look up in the employment tax section, and that's a new one. Let's see what they're going after. You can cite, if the IRS employee is violating the Internal Revenue Manual, you can very politely cite it to them. They don't have it memorized. They were trained it a long time ago. It's constantly changing. And you can point things out to them and they'll go, oh, okay. So I really, you know, I mean, that's what I'd be recommending to anybody. It's your friend.
I agree with that.
Yeah,
I agree with that. I like your tips and recommendations, the Form 8821. I think practitioners should look that up, whether you're doing tax return preparation or tax resolution cases. Definitely the IRM, I agree, is your friend in letting you know how the agent is going to be working with you on your client's issue. And the software package, the tools that pull down, as we say, transcripts, because knowing what's in the transcripts, the different things that transcripts tell you, you know, when your client doesn't have any notices or your anymore, when your client, who knows, they've moved and they didn't get half these notices, you name it, but or what they haven't told you, you gather, you know, information from looking at these transcripts, and very importantly, about the collection statute's expiration date. When is that 10-year collection statute going to expire? And your strategy, how you look at the strategy for the taxpayer and resolve, what type of resolution program would you qualify them for that takes that into consideration and seeing if it can work for the client down the road. Excellent, excellent tips and recommendations. But Charles, thank you. I can't thank you enough for your time and your expertise and your wisdom. And I really appreciate it, you taking the time out.
Very good.
Now, hopefully I see you at the Taxpayer Defense Conference, whether this fall in Houston, whether you're able to come in person or attend virtually. I'm going in person, and I will wave to you virtually if you're not able to attend in person.
Yep. It's probably might be virtual this year. Yep.
Understood. Yep. All right. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Thanks.